in brief. And he has mentioned how the Supreme Lord has come to this material world to reclaim all the conditioned souls and to take them back to Godhead. And the process of doing it, the process of going back to Godhead, is actually Sanatana Dharma. So that is going to be the topic that Srila Prabhupada will discuss actually over the next 2 or 3 pages. So probably he has reserved the longest discussion for this topic, and he has clarified many, many important points here. So let's begin from page 18, second paragraph. Quote, "Therefore, Sanatana Dharma does not refer to any sectarian process of religion. It is the eternal function of the eternal living entities in relationship with the eternal Supreme Lord. Sanatana Dharma refers, as stated previously, to the eternal occupation of the living entity. Sripad Ramanujacharya has explained the word Sanatana as that which has neither beginning nor end. So when we speak of Sanatana Dharma, we must take it for granted on the authority of Sripad Ramanujacharya that it has neither beginning nor end." Unquote. So Prabhupada begins by saying that Sanatana Dharma does not refer to any sectarian process of religion. It is an eternal process because it refers to the eternal function of the eternal soul in relationship with the eternal Supreme Lord. And eventually it takes one to the eternal world, the spiritual world, the Sanatana Dham. So the word Sanatana has been used many times here and previously as well. And as Sripad Ramanujacharya has described in this paragraph, the word Sanatana means that which has neither beginning nor end. In other words, eternal. So Sanatana Dharma also is a dharma that has no beginning. It has a dharma that has no end. It's an eternal dharma. Therefore, you cannot identify it with some particular caste or a creed or a community or a nationality or a group of people, a group of living entities, because it's something much more than that. The Bhagavad Gita is a book of Sanatana Dharma. It's not a book that gives some religious beliefs of a particular class of people. It talks about certain principles and laws in nature even. For example, when the Bhagavad Gita says that we are all eternal souls, it's a fact that is valid for everyone, not just for Hindus or Vaishnavas. When the Gita says that there is a material world that is created, sustained and destroyed, it's valid simply because it appears to be a so-called Hindu book. It doesn't mean that it's not true. These are laws of nature, principles of nature, both the higher nature and the lower nature, that are given here in the Bhagavad Gita. It applies everywhere to all. We see that some scientists, like there is one called Dr. Ian Stevenson, he had done a lot of studies on reincarnation. He would interview people who remembered their previous lives. And he would try to establish on a scientific basis that these people actually were speaking the truth, that this was not a hoax. And his study encompassed people from all different continents of the world. Of course, there were a large number from India, but there were also people from Europe, from America, from the Middle East, from Africa, and there were people of different religions also. There were some Muslims from Lebanon and other places who also remembered the previous lives and who were interviewed. So it means that the presence of a previous life or an afterlife is not dependent on what religion we belong to or what nationality we belong to, inasmuch as the fact that an apple will fall to the ground when dropped is true regardless of whether we are Hindus or Muslims or Christians or Indians or whatever we are. So therefore, what is given here in the Bhagavad Gita is Sanatana knowledge. Knowledge of the eternal, eternal principles. Even the laws of nature are eternal. Even though the Prakriti itself is manifested at a certain point in time and then maintained and destroyed, but the principles of Prakriti are the same. Even when this creation is destroyed and the next creation comes up, we will still have the same truths that the Bhagavad Gita is saying. There will still be reincarnation, there will still be birth, death, old age, disease, there will still be the eternal souls. So despite the fact that the material cosmos may be created and destroyed from time to time, the laws of nature that operate even within the temporary material universe are eternal. Although they don't get an opportunity to be applied eternally, because there are periods when the universe is in the phase of destruction. But the principles are there. The Vedas are nothing but the breathing of Lord Narayan. That is what is described in the Shastra. Because Lord Narayan is eternal, he is eternally breathing, so the Vedas are also eternal. Whatever knowledge they say is also eternal. So therefore, a student of the Bhagavad Gita understands this point, that the things mentioned here don't belong to any particular group or any community. The fact that we believe in Krishna doesn't necessarily make us only Hindus. We believe in Krishna because this is Sanatana Dharma, because this textbook of Sanatana Dharma says so. It's not because I'm born in a particular class of people that I automatically accept that Krishna is God. We accept Krishna as God because this Sanatana Dharma scriptures say so. So let us read further ahead. Now Srila Prabhupada will distinguish between religion and dharma, Sanatana Dharma. Very, very important conceptually for all of us to understand very clearly this point. Let us read. The English word religion is a little different from Sanatana Dharma. Religion conveys the idea of faith, and faith may change. One may have faith in a particular process, and he may change this faith and adopt another. But Sanatana Dharma refers to that activity which cannot be changed. For instance, liquidity cannot be taken from water, nor can heat be taken from the fire. Similarly, the eternal function of the eternal living entity cannot be taken from the living entity. Sanatana Dharma is eternally integral with the living entity. When we speak of Sanatana Dharma, therefore, we must take it for granted on the authority of Sripad Ramanujacharya that it has neither beginning nor end. That which has neither end nor beginning must not be sectarian, for it cannot be limited by any boundaries. Those belonging to some sectarian faith will wrongly consider that Sanatana Dharma is also eternal. But if we go deeply into the matter and consider it in the light of modern science, it is possible for us to see that Sanatana Dharma is the business of all the people of all the world, nay, of all the living entities of the universe. Unquote. So now, without looking down in the books, can somebody say what is the difference between religion and Sanatana Dharma? Yes. Religion is a kind of faith. Like what? Give an example. Hindu, Muslim, Christian. So this is a kind of faith. And? Sanatana Dharma refers to that which is not just a faith. It refers to something which is eternal. It is the eternal function of the living entity. It cannot be changed. Prabhupada is mentioning here that faith can be changed. One may have faith in a particular process and he may change this faith and adopt another. So a Hindu may become a Muslim may become a Christian may become a Buddhist may become a Jew may become an atheist. Anything can happen. Faith can change. But that doesn't mean that the living entity Sanatana Dharma has changed. Sanatana Dharma remains exactly what the term implies. Sanatana, eternal. It never changes. Why doesn't it change? Why is religion something that is that keeps changing, that can change? And why is it that Sanatana Dharma can never change? Yes, somebody else. So yes. It has come from Krishna. Because it has come from Krishna. Well, we can also, the answer, one answer is that because Sanatana Dharma has come from Krishna, therefore it is eternal, alright. But at the same time, we also accept from Prabhupada's teachings that in some of the other bona fide religions of the world, we accept that some of their prophets are bona fide prophets. They may have presented things according to time, place and circumstance. They may not have presented the knowledge as completely as we understand from Gita and Bhagavatam. But nevertheless, Prabhupada accepted that Christ was the Son of God. He accepted that there were other prophets in this world also who came to give the message of God, spread the word of God. So to some extent it is not wrong to say that they are also coming from Krishna. So there is another reason why we say the religion changes whereas Sanatana Dharma never changes. Yes.
Also, Sanatana Dharma refers to the inherent characteristic of the living entity, which cannot be changed. Just as the example was given as liquidity cannot be taken away from water, sweetness cannot be taken away from sugar.
The Sanatana Dharma is the eternal character of the living entity, therefore it cannot be changed. Yes. But I am looking for a simpler explanation in just two words. Religion is connected to something, therefore it's temporary. Sanatana Dharma is connected to something, therefore it is eternal. Religion is connected to the body. The body is eternal, temporary. Therefore, religion is temporary. Sanatana Dharma is connected to the soul. The soul is temporary. No? Eternal. The soul is eternal. Therefore, Sanatana Dharma is eternal.
Maybe I identify Sanatana Dharma with Vedas.
That's alright. But Prabhupada is defining here that Sanatana Dharma is the eternal function of the living entity. Who is eternal? When we talk of the living entity, who is eternal? The soul. So it is the eternal function of the eternal soul. Because it is a function of something that is eternal, therefore the process itself is also eternal. When the foundation of something is eternal, the structure is also is eternal. But if the foundation is temporary, there is no question of the structure becoming permanent. Religion, as Prabhupada says here, is based on some kind of faith. Faith keeps changing. As I gave the example, we keep changing our religious faith because it's based on the body. If what to speak of this life, we may change life to life as well. There were changes I mentioned about reincarnation studies. There were cases when people changed their religions also. There is one lady from the National Institute of Mental Health and Neurosciences in Bangalore, NIMHANS. She has done a lot of research on this as well. I think she did her PhD on this topic. And she analyzed the studies in different categories. And she analyzed not only how people from different communities, different religious faiths, remembered their past lives, but she also indicated that there was change of religion as well in different lives. In one life there is a Hindu, next life is a Muslim. In this life is a Muslim, next life is a Hindu. So these things have also been noted in the reincarnation studies. So we can see that these things are temporary because it depends on the body. And even when the body is still the same more or less, the mind is changing. So today is Hindu, tomorrow is no, I'll be Muslim. The body is changing, the mind is changing, so religion changes. All these other religious processes that have come in history have had a beginning in time. When did Christianity begin? Roughly 2000 years ago. As Christ put it, as Jesus Christ appeared about 2000 years ago. When did Islam begin? About 1500 years ago, 500 and something. That was where Prophet Muhammad lived. When did Sikhism begin? About a couple of centuries ago, about 500 years ago, when Guru Nanak appeared in Punjab. Like this, you analyze any of the main religions of the world, you will see they originated at some point in time. There was someone who was the founder of that religion, some prophet, some messiah who came. But Prabhupada has pointed out time and time again that for Sanatan Dharma, there is no beginning. And Prabhupada quotes Ramanujacharya on the word Sanatan as to mean that which has no beginning and no end. One devotee was in a hospital and there was a Parsi doctor, very well-known doctor, who came to treat him. He was very expert and acknowledged in his field, very big man. So he saw the devotee in wearing saffron cloth and he started talking to him. And he said, actually, Zoroastrianism is the oldest religion in the world. He said, because even your Vedas, they were made only 5,000 years ago. Whereas the Zoroastrian religion comes much before that. And he tried to give some historical evidence. The Vedas may have been compiled 5,000 years ago, but that doesn't mean that the knowledge of the Vedas is 5,000 years old. It doesn't mean that Sanatana Dharma is 5,000 years old. It's just that Vyasadeva edited all the Vedas and put them on paper, so to speak, in writing. Prior to Kali Yuga, in the previous ages, knowledge was simply remembered. It was spoken, heard, and remembered. There was no need to write down because everyone had such sharp memories. They were Shruti Dhara. They could remember whatever they heard. So because it was put down in writing, a certain different edition of the Vedas was published, so to speak. It doesn't mean that Vedic knowledge began at that time. Suppose there is a mathematics textbook that was published 100 years ago and then it is revised and published again 10 years ago. Do we say that mathematics began 10 years ago? Mathematics as a science has been known for centuries. It's just that it was presented in a particular form and published in a certain manner at this point in time. So because the Vedic scriptures appeared in a particular form 5,000 years ago, it doesn't mean that Vedic knowledge appeared 5,000 years ago. In the Bhagavad Gita also we hear Krishna saying, Imam vivasvate yogam proktavan aham avyayam Vivasvan manave praha manur ikshvakave bravid. I spoke this message first to the sun god, who then spoke it to his son Manu. Manu spoke it to his son Ikshvaku. And Prabhupada calculates that as being more than 120 million years ago. So how does that compare with 5,000 years or 7,000 years? And even then, that was not the beginning. This Vedic knowledge has been existing eternally. So long as Krishna has been there, the knowledge has been there. And how long has Krishna been there? Eternally. Anadi, anadi radir govindaha. So the Sanatana Dharma is existing eternally. There is no question of any beginning. It's just that every time there is a new creation, Brahmaji doesn't know what this knowledge is, and Krishna comes and empowers him. Tene brahma hridaya adikavaye. Then from within his heart and sometimes from outside, he gives knowledge to Brahma about the Vedas. When Krishna plays the flute in Goloka Vrindavan, the sound of his flute travels outwards into the entire spiritual world. It penetrates the Viraja river and also the coverings of the universe, seven layers. And it comes, enters into Brahma's ear as the Omkar, and comes out of Brahma's mouth as the Gayatri Mantra, also forms the Vedas. So Brahma is the original speaker of the Vedas in this material world. But he does that after he is duly initiated by Krishna. So Brahma is the first initiated devotee in this world. But he was directly initiated by Krishna. And he was initiated by the flute. Sometimes Prabhupada would initiate in emergency cases on the phone. Or he would initiate by letter. There are rare cases like this. Although generally the process was everybody would come in front of a fire sacrifice and he would then give a name and all that. But sometimes he would also do it on the phone in rare cases. Similarly, this is a rare case. Krishna directly, telephonically, by transcendental telephone, he initiated Brahma. So Brahma forgets. In fact, when the Brahma's night comes and he goes to sleep, and when he wakes up in the morning, sometimes he forgets also. And he has to be reminded again by Krishna. One time Brahma was, he nodded off to sleep. Just like sometimes we do when we sit in the class or sit in chanting. We're hearing and then we just nod off to sleep for a moment till the neighbor wakes us up. And at that time, the Vedas came from his mouth and was stolen by a demon. What was his name? Yes? Madhu and Kaitab, yes. And then Krishna had to come and kill the demons and revive, restore the Vedas again to Brahma. So we could go back not just 5,000 years ago, not just 120 million years ago, go back to the beginning of Brahma, the beginning of the universe. Then somebody may argue the Vedas began, Sanatana Dharma began with the creation of the universe. No, not even that. In the spiritual world, the Vedas are always with Krishna. So when every time the universe is created or Brahma's day begins, the memory has to be given fresh to him. He has to be coached again in the Vedas. So in every universe this pastime is going on. And all the billions and billions of universes, every Brahma has to be reminded again and again about the Vedas. So what is this 5,000, 7,000, 10,000 years? It's insignificant in the span of eternity. So truly, this is Sanatana Dharma. There is no question, no comparison of any other process. Everything else is temporary. So to conclude, religion means faith, religious faith. And these things change and are temporary because they are based on the temporary platform of the body. If I am born in a certain family, if I am born in a Muslim family, I say I am Muslim. If I am born in a Christian family, I am a Christian. when the Chinese devotees had come here, I asked them, what was your religion before you became a Hare Krishna devotee? They said, no religion. So when in the religion column they write no religion, because they're communists. Communism is an atheistic religion. Some days ago I read a news item that said that in Australia, they say almost 19 to 20% of the people say they have no religion. When they ask to fill in a form with all their personal details, and one of the details says religion, so many of them say no religion. 20% of the population, 1 in 5 Australians, doesn't believe in God. So it's ever changing. So if one is born in a family of an atheist, like some of the Chinese, and they became atheists also, they said, I'm an atheist, I have no religion. Why? Because my parents were, they had no religion. I am a Christian. Why? Because my parents are Christians. My relatives are Christians. So this is dependent on the body. So religion or religious faith is dependent on the body and is therefore temporary, whereas Sanatan Dharma is based on the soul, and so it is eternal. So let us go ahead and read further. Prabhupada also happens to mention in this the example of liquidity cannot be taken from water, nor can heat be taken from fire, to indicate that Sanatana Dharma is that which can never be taken away from the living entity. It remains. Just like, for example, can you take away liquidity from water? What would you say? Think carefully. So give me the answer. Can you take away liquidity from water? You have to give me a complete answer. Qualify your yes or your no by some explanation. Not don't just say yes or no. Yes, that's the answer. You have to specify also. Can you take away liquidity of water? No, not in the natural condition. So obviously that implies yes, in the artificial condition you can. So water is liquid only at certain temperature, which is for us so-called normal. So in this temperature range, it is natural for water to be liquid. But if you change the temperature to some very, very low temperature, which is not natural for the water, then it becomes solid. So it appears to acquire a different character. Although fundamentally, liquidity remains the property of water, it is just that you have exposed or you have imposed an artificial condition on that water, and therefore it has lost its apparent natural characteristic. But you bring back the natural condition and immediately the liquidity comes back, its natural character comes back. In the same way, the living entity's dharma is Sanatana. It is to serve Krishna eternally. That's the character of the soul. And Prabhupada will be building up to this point gradually. But in an unnatural condition, what is that unnatural condition? The influence of Maya. Under the influence of the material nature, the jiva seems to lose his original character. Actually, he doesn't. It is still there. Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Sathya Kabunoy Shravanadi Shuddha Chitte Karay Udaye. So this Krishna Prema is dormant in the soul. It's there in the heart of every living entity. It has to be awakened by creating the natural atmosphere for the soul, which is devotional service. Just like a fish, his natural condition is the water. So for the soul, the natural atmosphere is devotional service. So you place the soul once again in devotional service, which is its natural atmosphere, and its natural characteristic, which is dormant, which is hidden, will again come up to the surface. And the artificial atmosphere has appeared to bring out a characteristic that is not natural. So therefore, under the influence of Maya, the living entity assumes characters or characteristics that are not natural. Because the influence of Maya is not a natural condition or not a natural atmosphere for the soul. But bring back the soul to Krishna consciousness and everything flourishes again. The original condition is back. Just like heating the ice again. And then when the temperature is in the normal range, once again it flows. It is natural. So Sanatana Dharma is that which is a natural condition of the living entity. The original character of the living entity in its natural condition. So when people say, why are you people living such an unnatural life? You are depriving yourself of this and that. When Prabhupada, one of his godbrothers went to London to preach because Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur had sent them there, he said, go and make brahmanas. And one so-called lord, he came to these preachers and said, well, can I also become a brahmana? So the sannyasis replied, yes, but you have to follow the four regulative principles. No meat eating, no illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling. So then the Lord replied, forget it, impossible. So they were thinking, it's so unnatural. How is it possible for us to follow these principles which are so unnatural? So because of being in this unnatural atmosphere for a long time, the living entity begins to think it is a natural thing. Just like a person who has been in the jail, suppose there's a child who was born in the jail, or just came in when he was newly born, and he's there all along in the jail. So when he grows up, all he knows is the jail. So he thinks that is his real life. He doesn't remember any other life. So the living entities have been so long in this material creation that they think this is the natural condition. And that all the urges and all the desires that come in the mind of the living entity is a natural desire of the soul. Many times you have people who come and say, music is the soul, is a life for the soul. Yes, but which kind of music? Not your kind of music. Devotional music, yes, that is food for the soul. So all we have to do is to revive that natural atmosphere. That is very important. So therefore here in Krishna Balaram Mandir, Prabhupada has created facilities for a wonderful natural atmosphere for the soul. Beautiful deities, darshan and worship. Very wonderful chanting of the holy names. Krishna Katha. Opportunities for service and association of devotees, taking Krishna Prasadam. So it's an atmosphere where the natural condition of the soul may be revived, so that automatically then the natural character of the soul will manifest. You don't have to do anything else. Just remain in that atmosphere and the character will come. Just keep applying heat to the ice. You don't have to do anything else. The water will automatically regain its natural characteristic of liquidity. So this is the nature of the soul, Sanatana Dharma. And now because of this artificial condition of forgetfulness of Krishna, we think that forgetfulness is natural and that remembrance is artificial. There are so many people who chastise their relatives. Okay, it's nice you're going to God, but don't overdo it. Don't do too much. What is this? This Hare Krishna all day. What is this? It's unnatural. Do a little bit something. We appreciate that. But don't overdo it. So this is the way we compromise with the natural and the artificial. So accustomed have we become to the artificial. So let us go ahead and read the next paragraph. Non-Sanatana religious faith may have some beginning in the annals of human history, but there is no beginning to the history of Sanatana Dharma because it remains eternally with the living entities. Unquote. This is what we just mentioned. There are all these other religions like Islam, Christianity, Sikhism, etc. They all began at a certain point in history. But not so with Sanatana Dharma. No beginning, no end. Again, continue. Insofar as the living entities are concerned, the authoritative Shastras state that the living entity has neither birth nor death. In the Gita it is stated that the living entity is never born and he never dies. He is eternal and indestructible. And he continues to live after the destruction of his temporary material body. In reference to the concept of Sanatana Dharma, we must try to understand the concept of religion from the Sanskrit root, meaning of the word. Dharma refers to that which is constantly existing with a particular object. We conclude that there is heat and light along with the fire. Without heat and light, there is no meaning to the word fire. Similarly, we must discover the essential part of the living being, that part which is his constant companion. That constant companion is his eternal quality, and that eternal quality is his eternal religion. Unquote. Prabhupada starts this paragraph by talking about how the Sanatana Dharma remains eternally with the living entities. He refers to the basic philosophy of the Gita that we are the eternal soul and not this body. And because the Sanatana Dharma is connected to the soul, it is also eternal. And then he defines Dharma. Can somebody define Dharma without looking? Yes. Dharma of an object refers to that which constantly remains with the object. So material desires are constantly with us. So material desires are our dharma. Right? By your definition, what is wrong with this logic? Yes. Yes, material desires are not always there. Material desires, they keep changing. It's not the natural quality of the soul to have material desires. But if you talk about the conditioned soul, yes, in a sense, pervertedly, that is his dharma. The perverted reflection of pure love of God is lust, sense gratification. So the perverted dharma for this conditioned living entity, or that which a living entity is never separated from, to which the living entity spontaneously and naturally is attracted, is sense gratification. That is his perverted dharma. But here we are talking not about the body, we are talking about the soul. So there is something that constantly exists with the soul. There is something that cannot be separated from an object. That is its dharma. So Prabhupada has defined the word dharma here to mean that dharma of an object is that quality of an object that cannot be separated from that object, that constantly exists with that object. And what example does he give? Heat and light. The dharma of fire is heat and light. If you separate heat and light from fire, then fire doesn't remain fire. The dharma of water is liquidity. The dharma of sugar is sweetness. So what is the dharma of the living entity? What is that quality? Or what is that constant companion of the living entity, which is his dharma? That Srila Prabhupada is going to talk about now. He has come to the point when he is saying that Sanatana Dharma is different from religious faith ordinarily understood in this world, because Sanatana Dharma refers to that quality or function of the soul which cannot be separated. So what is that quality? He is going to now try to logically come to this point. So let's read from the next paragraph. We are on page 19 now. When Sanatan Goswami asked Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu about the Swaroop of every living being, the Lord replied that the Swaroop or constitutional position of the living being is the rendering of service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If we analyze this statement of Lord Chaitanya's, we can easily see that every living being is constantly engaged in rendering service to another living being. A living being serves other living beings in various capacities. By doing so, the living entity enjoys life. The lower animals serve human beings as servants serve the master. A serves B master, B serves C master, C serves D master, and so on. Under these circumstances, we can see that one friend serves another friend, the mother serves the son, the wife serves the husband serves the wife, and so on. If we go on searching in this spirit, it will be seen that there is no exception in the society of living beings to the activity of service. The politician presents his manifesto for the public to convince them of his capacity for service. The voters therefore give the politician their valuable votes, thinking that he will render valuable service to society. The shopkeeper serves the customer, and the artisan serves the capitalist. The capitalist serves the family, and the family serves the state in terms of the eternal capacity of the eternal living being. In this way, we can see that no living being is exempt from rendering service to other living beings. And therefore, we can safely conclude that service is the constant companion of the living being, and that the rendering of service is the eternal religion of the living being. Unquote. So Prabhupada mentions a couple of points here. One, he gives Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's definition of our constitutional position, which is Jivera Swarup Hoy Krishner Nitya Das, that the eternal constitutional position of the soul is to always serve Krishna. Secondly, Prabhupada makes the point here that every living being is constantly engaged in rendering service to others. And he elaborates by giving so many examples. So this is the crux of the matter, that no living being can live without serving other living beings. Why? Because it is his nature to do so. And another reason that is mentioned by Prabhupada here is that that is the only way the living being attains happiness. Earlier also we have been discussing that happiness exists only in relationships. Isn't it? Do you remember a couple of days ago we talked on this point? Relationships mean service. So if we are serving another living being, there is a relationship and there is some happiness that comes out of it. In the perverted form, there is distress. So the living entity's natural function is to serve another living entity. And it is natural because it is only in that service that the living entity gets happiness. And we all realize that it gives more happiness to serve than to be served, even for Krishna. And after having given various examples of this, then he concludes that the dharma of the soul is what? Service. So first Prabhupada began by defining dharma of an object as that which is its constant companion, or that which can never be separated from that object. Then he gave examples to illustrate the point. Then he explains how the nature of the living entity is to serve other living entities in order to get happiness. That is the nature of living beings. And therefore the dharma of all living entities is to serve other living entities. But please note, this is only dharma, not Sanatana dharma. Why? Why? Yes. Right. Because generally speaking, our serving propensity is directed towards people and objects that are not temporary. That is, I beg your pardon, not eternal. That are temporary. Therefore, that dharma is temporary. For example, worship of the demigods. We serve the demigods in some way. So we are serving. Prabhupada is saying here that the dharma of the living entities is to serve. So we are serving the exalted demigods. Why is that not Sanatana dharma? Because the demigods are not eternal. So therefore that relationship between the worshipper of the demigod and the demigod is also not eternal. So it is, the worship is executed as part of the living entity's dharma being to serve, but it is not Sanatana dharma. Because the object of worship is not Sanatana, is not eternal. Only when the serving propensity is directed towards Krishna and Krishna alone, then that dharma is called Sanatana dharma. Otherwise it is only ordinary dharma.
Not a dharma, perverted dharma.
No, it is dharma in the sense of the definition. The dharma of an object is that which constantly exists. So when we talk of dharma now, we are talking of the propensity to serve anyone. It may be anything or anyone. That is dharma. But Sanatana dharma is that which pertains only to Krishna, only to the Supreme Lord, no one else. Many times we see different slogans put up on the walls, graffiti and so on. We have many people coming to say, Netradan Shreshtadan. They say donating your eyes is the topmost gift. The topmost dharma is to give to the poor. Someone says this dharma is the highest, that dharma is the highest. Taking care of the poor and the needy is the highest dharma. So everyone advocates his particular dharma according to his conception of service. Those who are serving the poor are also doing dharma because they are serving. Those who are serving the rich are also doing dharma because they are also serving. Everyone is doing some form of dharma in terms of this definition, mind you. But only the devotees of the Lord are rendering Sanatana dharma. So that is the point to be understood from this passage. So we'll stop here. Are there any questions or comments? Yes.
We are serving others because our nature is
to serve.
Service.
Yes.
We require to serve Krishna. If we are not serving Krishna, so we are serving others.
Yes.
And if anybody has nobody to serve, he just brings dog.
Yes.
So it is our nature, but we are not in a particular form or in a particular position to serve Krishna, but our nature is there, so we are serving.
Correct. Absolutely right. So it's not a question, it is just a repetition of what has been discussed, a revision, so to speak. It is our nature to serve. If we don't serve Krishna, we will serve anybody else, but we must serve. And if we don't have any human beings to serve, we will serve animals, birds, or anything else. But serve, we must. We have no choice, because that is our nature. It is only in our interest to see that the serving propensity is directed towards the Supreme Lord Shri Krishna. Yes, any other? Somebody raised the hand behind here. Yes.
Yes.
especially this, we say that he is serving, nature is not served. But his service is not for the person's benefit, it's for his own enjoyment or benefit. So that also is different because A serving B, B serving C. It's not selfless, it's because of his own interest, he wants to get some money.
The question is that in the ordinary so-called service of this world, A serves B, B serves C, and so on, each person is serving, each living entity is serving not out of a selfless desire but with some motivation to enjoy something. Is it still dharma? Well, it is not dharma in the sense of it being a religious act, but it is dharma in terms of this definition that Prabhupada has given here, that dharma is that quality of the soul that is its constant companion. So because the living entity's natural tendency is to serve, so he will serve so many living forms. And till such time as we serve Krishna, our service will not be selfless. It is not possible for selfless service to exist in this material world. It is very rare to find anything resembling completely selfless service. Prabhupada said one time, the closest thing that comes in the material world to the pure service of the spiritual world is the service of the mother for a child. That's the closest thing that comes. But otherwise, at a subtle or gross level, there are always so many things we seek in this world from service, from our service. As Prabhupada says, the politician promises the world to the voters, but he has his motives. But when we serve Krishna, even though initially we may have some ulterior motives, but simply by being in contact with Krishna, we get purified of those ulterior motives, just like Dhruva Maharaj did. So therefore the Bhagavatam says, akamo sarva kamo va moksha kama udarabhi tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param. Now whether one is akama, without material desires, whether one is sarva kama, full of material desires, whether one is moksha kami, desiring liberation, one must with great intensity, tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param, one must with great intensity worship the Supreme Lord. When we serve other living beings, we do have some selfish desires, and in continuing to serve those entities, we don't become free from those selfish desires. So those selfish desires remain. But if we approach Krishna, even if it is with some material desire, we will eventually become purified. We will become pure. So then that service, that dharma becomes pure. In this world, when the serving propensity is directed to everything, anything other than Krishna, it is also somewhat impure. But when redirected to Krishna, then it becomes purified by contact with the Supreme All Pure. Another question somebody had? Yes. Is the service not eternal?
Service to Shiva.
The question is regarding, because it was mentioned that the service to the demigods is also temporary, so what about service to Lord Shiva, for example? Who would like to answer this? Yes. Is
Krishna.
Well, Lord Shiva is a Krishna Bhakta, therefore you can get devotional service to Krishna through him, yes. But suppose someone is worshipping Lord Shiva just like any other demigod worshipper is worshipping the other demigods. The question is that Lord Shiva is permanent, is eternal. So is our service to Lord Shiva not Sanatan Dharma? Yes. But even my presence in this body while worshipping Krishna is temporary.
Material motive is temporary.
Shiva. Material motive is temporary, alright?
Shiva is connected to this materialist world.
Yes. Because Shiva, as he appears in this world, has a connection with this material world. You know the difference between Krishna and Shiva, right? Kshiram yatha tadhivikara vishesha yoga sanjayate nahi tatah pritag asti hetoho. So the difference between Shiva and Krishna is that like the difference between milk and yogurt, milk and curd. So both are essentially the same. There's only difference of one drop. Just put one drop of citric acid in the milk and becomes curd. The one drop. But so actually it's the same, but still in function it's different. When you have loose motions, you take curd. If you take milk when you have loose motions, then it increases the loose motion. They have opposite effect actually on the stomach. So when you have loose motions, you take curd to cure yourself of the loose motions. Right? So, although Shiva is one with Krishna, but he's still different because he is adulterated, so to speak, by contact with the material modes of nature. And because of that contact, worship of this Lord Shiva doesn't give eternal benefit. Especially to those who worship him without proper understanding. Shiva, of course, is an exalted soul. And we must understand that there are many Shivas. How many Shivas are there? Not just 11. There are the 11 Rudra forms, that's right. But in every universe there is a Shiva, isn't it? As many universes there are in this material cosmos, there are that many Lord Shivas. But all these Shivas ultimately come from the original Shambhu principle. And in that Shambhu principle, there he is eternal. There is that Mahakala, that place which is the borderline between the material world and the spiritual world. So at that place, yes, they reside there. But ordinarily, for those who worship Shiva, it is not easy to just get eternal because those who worship Shiva are usually in the mode of ignorance themselves. Like the bhutas, pretas, the ghosts, hobgoblins, those who are addicts of so many things. In Bombay, there is a famous Lord Shiva temple called Bhuleshwar, which is close to our ISKCON temple there. And on Shivaratri, you will find a whole huge crowd of these sadhus who are there. Sitting, the whole streets are crowded with these sadhus, and each one of them has their intoxication which they take sitting on the road. So they are quite in the mode of ignorance, although they are sadhus and everything like that. So that doesn't yield eternal benefit. But when you take the milk instead of taking the curd, then that yields eternal benefit. In other words, when you worship Krishna, not Krishna in his form of Lord Shiva, but Krishna in his original form or his pure transcendental forms, the Vishnu Tattvas, then you can get liberation. Yes.
As we explain now that Lord Shiva is connected with the material world, that is of ignorance. But Vishnu is also connected with the material.
The question is that Lord Shiva is connected with the material mode of ignorance, but isn't Lord Vishnu also connected with the material mode of goodness?
Yes, but
So then, should the worship of Vishnu also not be temporary? Yes, somebody please answer. Yes? Correct. Although Vishnu is in charge of the mode of goodness, but he is not in contact with the mode. He is aloof. He is always transcendental. Tribhir gunamaye revai ebhi sarvam idam jagat. The whole jagat, everything is under the three modes, but I am not under the three modes. So even though Vishnu is transcendent, is in charge of the mode of goodness, he remains out of contact, out of touch. Whereas Shiva and Brahma touch, so to speak, the modes of nature. Brahma touches the mode of passion. Shiva touches the mode of ignorance. But Vishnu doesn't touch the mode of goodness. He remains aloof. Yes. The question is, just as there is a Lord Shiva and Brahma in every universe, so also there is a Lord Vishnu in every universe. So at the end of the creation, these Vishnus also merge back into Mahavishnu. So then, they are also temporary, but still they are eternal. They are temporary and yet eternal, because they are forms of the Supreme Lord, who is transcendental to matter. All the forms of the Lord, they remain. Just like when Krishna descends, all the avatars are present in him. The innumerable expansions and forms of the Lord all exist in that one personality, Krishna, when he descends. So it's not that they disappear, they just unmanifest for some time. Then they manifest themselves again. These are different expansions of Krishna. So these expansions, it's constantly going on. So the expansions remain on the level of transcendence. So one gets the same benefit. Yes. So Shiva is a Param Vaishnav. Someone can argue that, well, I am worshipping Shiva and he is a great devotee and therefore I should get liberated. Yes, the answer please. Yes. Worshipping a devotee is not condemned, rather it is glorified. Not just not condemned, it's glorified. But the motivation is important, yeah, alright. Anything else? Yes. Only Krishna can give liberation, alright?
Yes. Please serve Shiva. Krishna will be pleased because we are serving a great Vaishnava.
If you serve Krishna as Shiva, Krishna will be pleased, alright?
And by when he will be pleased, he will
then he will liberate us, which means that if I worship, then I don't need to worship Krishna, I just worship Shiva and I can get liberated. Yes? Now, the answer is that although Shiva is a great Vaishnava, there is no doubt about that, but mostly those who worship Krishna do not do so with that understanding. They take Shiva as something else. They do not worship him with that idea in mind. How many are there who worship Lord Shiva by saying, "Oh my dear Lord Shiva, please bless me with devotion to Lord Krishna"? How many will say like that? Only the Vaishnavas will pray like that. The Shaivites usually don't pray like that. When Lord Nityananda Prabhu travelled to South India, among other places, this is described in the Chaitanya Bhagavat, then he saw the quarrels between the Vaishnavas and the Shaivites, the Vaishnavites and the Shaivites in South India, and he started laughing. He laughed heartily to himself because he understood that neither the Vaishnavites, the caste Vaishnavites, understood who Lord Shiva is, and neither did the Shaivites understand who Lord Vishnu is. So, and themselves, the Shaivas didn't understand the position of Lord Shiva. So Nityananda Prabhu had a good laugh about the whole thing and he came away. So when we understand the relative positions of Krishna and Shiva, then we really glorify Lord Shiva. Like in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, there's so much glorification of Lord Shiva. Even in the Bhagavatam, there's so much glorification. But it's done with the idea that Lord Shiva is a great Vaishnava. So most of the people who worship, they will not go there. Go to Kashi, go to Banaras. Go to Kashi Vishwanath temple. Thousands of people coming to worship Lord Shiva. Ask them, what is your conception of Lord Shiva? How many will tell you that Lord Shiva is a great Vaishnava, therefore I am worshipping him? But nevertheless, with whatever motive they worship him, because they are with him, they worship him, so Lord Shiva is very merciful. Lord Shiva's task is very difficult because he has to deal with people in the mode of ignorance. Very hard to deal with those in the mode of ignorance. Especially if you've tried dealing with ghosts, you will know what I'm speaking about. Ghosts, hobgoblins, insane people, drug addicts, those who are in a state of intoxication. How hard it is to deal with such people. So Lord Shiva's task is so difficult. It's only because he is compassion personified. Because he is such a great Vaishnava that he has accepted this thankless service of trying to deliver those who are in the mode of ignorance. So he does it, but in a gradual process. It takes a long time to purify them. And also Lord Shiva is Ashutosh. He gets pleased very easily. So sometimes the worshippers take advantage of that. And they approach him for some benefit. Lord Shiva happily gives some benefit, you know, he gives some benediction. And then later he realizes, oh, I shouldn't have given that. So therefore another name for Lord Shiva is Bholenath. Very simple by nature. Very simple. So he heartily gives blessings. You know the story of Bhasmasura, right? Vrikasur or Bhasmasura. He worshipped Lord Shiva and Lord Shiva so easily gave him benediction. Yes, what do you want? I'll give you anything you like. Give me the benediction that whosoever head I touch, it will smash to pieces. Yes, so be it. And Bhasmasura came straight to Lord Shiva to touch his head. And Lord Shiva had to run for his life. Until Lord Vishnu came to rescue him. And then Vishnu, no one can be a sweeter talker than Vishnu, the Lord himself. So he spoke in such a sweet way with Bhasmasura. He said, oh, this Lord Shiva, he doesn't need, his benedictions never work, I assure you. I've tried it, I've experienced it. But anyway, since you believe it, why don't you test it out on yourself first and see? So he touched his own head and he died. So Lord Shiva has to be compassionate like that, because otherwise how can you deal with the most fallen of the fallen conditioned souls in this universe?
It is said that if you serve Shiva, your Krishna bhakti is promoted.
It is said that if you serve Lord Shiva, you are promoted in your Krishna bhakti. Well, provided you do it with the right understanding. Serving Lord Shiva and worshipping him means following his instructions more than anything else. Superficial worship is not of so much value. There may be many who will go and pour milk on the Shivalinga, or they will offer bilva, bale leaves to the Shivalinga. All that is fine. But Shiva is more pleased when you follow his instruction. If you read Srimad Bhagavatam, you will read Lord Shiva's instructions. To whom?
Prachetas.
To the Prachetas. And he sings a song. What is it called? Rudra Gita. It is called a Rudra Gita. Just like we have Bhagavad Gita, Uddhav Gita, there is Rudra Gita also in the Bhagavatam, where Lord Shiva sings a song glorifying the Supreme Lord and tells the Prachetas who have been performing austerities to have his darshan that you chant this song glorifying Lord Krishna. So that is what pleases Lord Shiva. That is real worship of Shiva. Real worship of Lord Shiva means to follow in his footsteps and follow his instructions. He will be more pleased when we worship Krishna than when we worship him.
Suppose we go to some temple, there are different deities. Krishna is there, and Devi is there, Shiva is there, and suppose then we just go before Shiva and we worship him and ask, please give us Krishna Bhakti. Is it correct or not?
The question is that if we go to a temple where there are many demigods forms and there's also Krishna there, everyone is there. So if you go and ask the demigods, please give me Krishna Bhakti, is it alright or not? My response would be, why go to such a temple in the first place? Right? There is no need. If it so happens that we have gone to a holy place, and there we are, it's a very important temple of Lord Shiva. Like in Bhubaneswar, you go to Jagannath Puri in Bhubaneswar, you go to Bhubaneswar, there is a temple of Lord Shiva there, very famous temple. So we go there. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went. He did a lot of kirtan there. So we go, offer our obeisances and come. We pray for Krishna Bhakti. But just because we are passing by and we see some demigods' temples here, and we have here, what is that? Chintamani something, no? Chintamani place, some place called Chintamani something. What is that place? No, Chintamani something. Not Chintamani. Chintamani, there you have a deity of Durga Devi right on the front, facing the road. Chintamani, something like that. So, well, we're going by, you just happen to see Durga Devi, there you can bow your head, offer, yes? You can offer your respects, but doesn't mean you have to go there and offer worship and offer prayers and everything. We are busy enough serving Krishna. So we don't have the time to go everywhere and offer our respects and do insurance policies everywhere just in case our prayers to Krishna don't work somehow, then we are doing. So where we do come across some demigods, then yes, then you may offer respect, because one of the principles in the nectar of devotion is that we should not insult the demigods. We should be very respectful. We should not be disrespectful to the demigods. That will harm our bhakti. At the same time, we also have the injunction that you should not separately worship the demigods independent of Krishna. Isn't it?
That's why, yes, when you go to the temple and there are different deities, we worship Krishna and just go to other.
Yeah, therefore, no need to go to such a temple.
Generally, such temples are here.
So we don't need to go there. We are in Vrindavan. We have so many nice temples. Krishna Balaram is here, Radha Shyam Sundar, Gaur Nitai here. Sufficient for us. Isn't it? Yes, Mother. I didn't hear the question. Can somebody convey the question to me? Does Krishna also have some kind of dharma in terms of this definition? The definition of dharma here is that dharma is that quality that is a constant, that constantly exists with that object. So does Krishna have a dharma? Yes, who would like to answer this? Yes.
To enjoy.
To enjoy. He's the enjoyer. And what else? Bhakta Vatsal, to give mercy to his devotees. What else? To serve his devotees. So he also has his dharma. He has his nature. He is bound by his nature. Yes.
Krishna, but I cannot serve Krishna directly, and I don't want to serve anybody else because I don't.
to follow Krishna's instruction. The question is that we should serve Krishna directly, but we are not in the platform of serving Krishna directly. So what should be done? Well, the idea is, as we said, worship of Krishna means primarily following his instructions. He instructs us to do certain things, like, for example, chanting his holy names, associating with his devotees, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, and so on. We just do that, and that is worship of Krishna. So we'll stop here at 7 o'clock. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Gaur Premanande.
क्योंकि उसकी प्रवृत्ति सेवा करने की